Well, good morning, TNC family. On this final Sunday in April, we're here today. We are in part 4 of our series, which, to summarize where we've been, when you read the Bible and not a verse of the day or an inspirational quote to frame or for forming theological or political positions, but entering the story, reading large sections at a time, walking the Bible streets and hills, its alleys and valleys, and then letting that whole experience shape our brain chemistry and our hearts as we move through our days. Among the things you discover when you do this is your focus is just not on, do I believe the right things, or am I set up now to go into heaven after I die? Because that's not the focus of the characters in the story. Which is why, for example, if you just sit down and read the book of Acts in one or two sittings, I did that last week, it might take you a total of 90 minutes. What you see, feel, taste, smell is a church very much involved in love, inclusion, generosity, and extending the good news that Jesus has overcome the powers of evil, and therefore we can enter a new creation kind of life, one filled with freedom and joy and purpose and peace. And periodically, yes, there are sermons. There's actually approximately 14 mini sermons preached in the book of Acts, but not a single one contains any threat of eternal hell. And just one or two reference an ultimate resurrection, but not described as going to heaven, as a place removed from earth. Which is why historian and New Testament scholar N.T. Wright, in his newest book, writes this: we have got our story of salvation upside down. Ever since the early Middle Ages, at least, most Christians have supposed that the point of the Christian gospel was to enable saved human souls to go up into heaven. We've read Paul that way, but Paul never once mentions going to heaven in any of his letters. The eternal security of God's people in the New Testament has to do not with their supposed disembodied post-mortem bliss, but with the resurrection from the dead into the rescued and renewed creation where they will have a truly human role to play. The story the Bible tells is about God creating a world in which he intends to come and live with his human creatures. And the Bible ends not with saved souls going up into heaven, but with the new Jerusalem coming down to earth so that the dwelling of God is with humans. Said another way, Adam and Eve's mission in Eden was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, to radah, to reign, to abad and shamar, to protect and care for and add beauty to our world, and to do so in partnership with divinity. And that is still our job today, to become fully functioning humans as God always intended, creating, loving, restoring, lifting up, building a better world, living as members of the new creation. And so, last week I gave you the first 5 of 10 ways to build a better world. 10 commandments for the TNC community, we said. But of course, not official commandments. Just a way to talk about how to be a Jesus community that goes out and lives out the Genesis mandate to build better, wiser, more beautiful, loving, more just homes and places of work and communities and so on. And we did 5 commandments last week, and today we're going to do the last 5, commandments number 6 through 10, and mostly you'll see, like last week's 5, these 5 are also primarily individual practices, not corporate commandments. And that's because I only have control over me, and you only have control over you, and we aren't going to build a better world with better institutions and policies unless we become better humans. In the words of Jesus, what goes on inside determines what gets produced outside. Luke chapter 6, a good person brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil person brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. No good tree produces bad fruit. No bad tree produces good fruit. So, number 6, the 6th commandment for building a better world, and living as members of the new creation. Number six, thou shalt find the good. Thou shalt find the good, because when you read the biographies of Jesus, you see it, you feel it, you know it. Where other people see sin, Jesus sees forgiveness. Where others see a past, Jesus sees a future. Where others see old wine and old wineskins, Jesus sees new wine, new wineskins. While others see, don't break the law, Jesus sees, do, bring the good, always. And so you have stories like Peter and Andrew saying, ah, we're just fishermen. And Jesus says, ah, I can see it. You're on your way to fishing for humans. And Zacchaeus is like, I'm just a tax collector. And Jesus is like, perfect. I'm coming to your house. You're exactly the one to take on this new task. Mary says, I'm just not young anymore, and I haven't done very much with my life. And Jesus says, what you are going to do on this day will be remembered and shared and will be an inspiration for all generations to come across centuries and continents. It's just every situation Jesus goes into, he sees the possibilities. He sees the good. And he's not making up the good. He's actually doing what we have the power to do, which is to actually see that there is good to be found in every situation if we'll just look. And I hope you see that this would help our entire culture, because mostly what happens is there's an event. I remember when that train derailed in Ohio, and within days, one side says, oh, this happened because liberals don't care about rural America. And the other side says, oh, this happened because of corporate greed and cutting corners. And it was just one big blame festival, which is what happens too often in politics and workplaces and homes, where some folks don't want to see the good, they want to see the bad, and then point out the problems. But imagine instead if we followed this commandment, if we followed like the counsel of Abdu'l-Bahá, who was a leader in the Baha'i faith, which I don't know much about, but I do like what he says, quote, if a person has 10 good qualities and one bad one, look at the 10, forget the one. And if a person has 10 bad qualities and one good, look at the one and forget the 10. Now, obviously, this is not about ignoring what's important to be aware of, and this is not about ignoring the wrongs and the injustices in our world. Rather, this is about having an optimistic, solution-oriented, sunny disposition towards others, and even actually towards ourselves. By the way, the practical results of this kind of thinking, following this commandment, they've been documented over and over by good social science. David Gergen, the former Navy officer, then White House advisor to four presidents of both parties, currently a professor at Harvard University, in his book called Hearts Touched with Fire, a 2022 publication, he cites the work of Warren Bennis and Robert Thomas, famous leadership experts, who've published research in response to the question, why is it that certain people seem to naturally succeed and grow while others stumble again and again? Now listen, this is their answer. It's not the obstacles that somebody faces. It's how that person sees their obstacles. And how do they see them? As opportunities for discovering solutions and making progress. They just have this, what Gergen calls, a sunny temperament. Time, for example, is not limited. It's precious. The task is not boring. It is foundational to the ultimate beauty of the entire project. That person is not a jerk. I just don't think we know each other well enough yet. In the book, Gergen tells the story of Franklin D. Roosevelt a few days after his first inauguration in 1933, when FDR visits Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. on his 92nd birthday, and the two men talk for an hour. And when FDR leaves, Holmes turns to an associate and says of Roosevelt, quote, a second-class intellect, but a first-class temperament. And if you know your history, it was his temperament that allowed him to lead a nation through wars and crises of confidence. And Gergen goes on to write about how he and other leaders met with Nelson Mandela in the White House. And Mandela's most memorable counsel, he says, was, "Don't let your enemies gain an upper hand over your emotions. Stay positive," Mandela would always say. Now, I know easier said than done, which is why a wonderful prayer for each of us would be this. God, help me to see the good. Help me to see what you are up to in this situation. God, help me realize that wherever I go, you are there. Don't let me start my day thinking about what's bad and wrong, but rather thinking about what's right and true. This coffee, that sunshine, this music, that person's story, this conversation, this opportunity. In the words of Philippians 4:8, Paul says, "Brothers and sisters, whatever's true, whatever's noble, whatever's right, pure, lovely, and admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about those things." And I just think, TNC, if we'll honor this commandment, "Thou shalt find the good," we will, I believe, not only transform our world for the better, but find ourselves transforming from the inside out into the kind of human we were created to be. Which leads to the seventh commandment, number 7, thou shalt connect with nature. Because as we connect, we come into alignment with our created intent, and we understand more clearly the intentions of the Creator. As the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 1, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made." Or in the words of Galileo Galilei in the 17th century, quote, "God is known first through nature and secondly by Christian doctrine." Or as Italian philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas put it about 800 years ago, "Sacred writings are bound in two volumes, volume 1, that of creation, and volume 2, that of the scriptures." Or in the words of 21st century author Barbara Mahaney and her most recent book that we read together as a church family last summer, "Through nature, humans can best come to a deeper knowledge of God. For God has infused the natural world with symbol and meaning, and if only we read what's there in the trees and the storms and the stars and the hives, we might more fully comprehend the Creator. Nature itself reveals the divine." And I would just expand now this definition of what the word nature includes, because it's more than just outdoorsy kinds of things. Yes, it does involve connecting with that sunrise and that flower, but also connecting with that moment of friendship and laughter, because that too was made. That's part of the created intent. And so is that music and art, sports and exercise, physics and chemistry, phone calls and pickleball and reading and baking and working hard. And any way and any time that we connect with and add to the good in the world, we are connecting with God and with our created intent. Now, there are many strategies for connecting with nature, but there's one constant, and here it is. It's going to require slowing down, pausing, and taking in the moment. Richard Rohr, the Franciscan priest based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, he has a great chapter in his book, The Naked Now, called Three Ways to View the Sunset. And the chapter starts with this sentence: "Three men stood by the ocean looking at the same sunset." And then he goes on to describe what each one sees. One man takes in the sunset with his five senses, sees the beauty, feels the sun's waning warmth, listens to the sounds of the ocean and the birds as the sun sets. And this man just takes it in, no agenda, just allows the moment to do what it will. The second man senses all the same things, but considers the science, considers about how the Earth is rotating on its axis as it moves around the Sun in a dance with the other planets rotating and orbiting. The Sun too, by the way, hydrogen and helium, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen exploding and sending electromagnetic waves shooting out towards our Earth in a Milky Way galaxy amid billions of stars. And this second man realizes in this moment of connection that he's part of this grand universe. Or as the psalmist writes, "When I look at the sky and see the work of your fingers, the moon, the stars that you've set in place, what are mere mortals that you should think about them, human beings that you should care for them? And yet, O God, you have crowned them with glory and honor." And then there's the third man that Rohr talks about. He senses all the same things that the first two do, but as he connects, he senses the universe's order and rhythm. 24 hours a day, 365 a year, sunrise, sunset, summer, fall, winter, spring, seed time, harvest, timing, excellence. And as he connects, he reflects on his own life and its rhythms, and he feels a call to embrace and pursue healthy seasons and rhythms and days in his own life with joyful excellence. Commandment number 7 calls us to slow down and to connect with the way the universe was made. And I believe that doing so can transform you and me into the kind of humans we were created to be and help us build a better world. Thou shalt connect with nature, which leads to the 8th commandment, number 8, thou shalt take responsibility, because you do have some responsibility for the shape of your life. It's not totally up to you. You don't call all the shots, where you were born, who your parents are, how many siblings you have, who your early teachers in your life were, and so on. And a very complicated world, I know, has shaped many of the situations you find yourself in. So you don't get to determine everything, but you're also not a rock, which doesn't respond if someone picks it up, throws it against a tree, skips it across a pond, or lays it down as part of a garden path. And you're not a frog or a rabbit either, which does respond, but it doesn't ask how it ought to respond. You're more. You have the ability to ask the ought question. And because you can, you are responsible for whether or not you do. And in some ways, this is the most important responsibility of our lives, I think, which is to pray and think and discern as best we can what kind of life is truly worth living. And of course, this is not a smooth and easy task, because life will come with roadblocks and setbacks, with pain and trouble. As Jesus said, John chapter 16, in this world, you will have trouble. And so that will be part of what we have to take responsibility in. But if we will take responsibility, then we'll know that a large chunk of the pain that we will experience today and in the days ahead is linked to the choices that we make. Because while some pain is outside of our control, some pain is within our control. Like, you can choose the pain of dealing with your past, which might include professional counseling and working through some hard histories, or the pain of letting your past haunt your present. And you can choose the pain of living within your means today, or the pain of battling a mountain of debt tomorrow. You can choose the pain of studying for an exam today, or the pain of taking the test again and the class again tomorrow. You can choose the pain of obeying the law today, or the pain of consequences tomorrow. You can choose the pain of cardio exercise and healthy diet today, or the pain of physical and psychological problems tomorrow. And the question always is, will you take responsibility for these things and for all of your current assignments and attitudes in life, or not? I like the words of Teddy Roosevelt, who said, quote, "If you could kick the person in the pants responsible for most of your trouble, you wouldn't sit for a month." And so TNC, we're given this wonderful responsibility rooted in the Genesis Garden of Eden mandate to radah and abad and shamar, to pick up our shovels and paintbrushes and to take care with our words and actions and to make decisions that will actually shape our own lives and bring order, beauty, and abundance to all around us. which leads perfectly into commandment number 9, thou shalt gather together with others. Thou shalt gather together, because you just can't miss this if you enter the story of the scriptures, where from Genesis all the way through Revelation, we see people gathering together, working together, playing together, traveling together. There is no aloneness. Daily they met together in the temple courts. Weekly they gather for worship and learning. Every month for festivals and celebrations in person, face to face. This, by the way, is maybe the biggest downside of television and smartphones and social media, which is hardly social. Rather, it's led to an increase in aloneness and loneliness, depression and anxiety. And so commandment number 9 is about teamwork. Get together with others. Potlucks, game nights, choirs, carpools, clubs, dance classes, teams. Celebrate and be celebrated. Love and be loved. Encourage and be encouraged. We need to get together. And now, number 10, the 10th commandment. Thou shalt let love lead. Because there's nothing that love won't improve. No relationship it won't enhance, no storm it won't soothe, no fear it won't combat, no course of action it won't clarify. Let me read again, as we often do, the words of the Apostle Paul in his letter to the Corinthians. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, I'm nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. And the thing is, this isn't some statement of theology. This is a statement about reality, about the life of heaven on earth. Paul is saying that there is a force that will determine the success or failure of your life more than any other force, and that's the force of love and the extent to which you grow in it. And it won't just bring you joy and success and peace. It is the force that will most effectively help everybody around you too. So, here are 10 commandments. Thou shalt prioritize prayer. Thou shalt live today. Thou shalt pursue wisdom. Thou shalt increase generosity. Thou shalt prize humility. Thou shalt find the good. Thou shalt connect with nature. Thou shalt take responsibility. Thou shalt gather together, and thou shalt let love lead. 10 commandments for a better world, a world that God so loved that he made it good. Genesis chapter 1, it is good, it is good, it is good. And a world that God so loved that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. And a world that God still loves, which is why he calls us to be his partners in the ongoing recreation of our world. And this is the story of the scriptures and the story of humanity that we're invited to enter and to live from. Let's pray. God, we embrace this story today, the story of love, that you love us and have called us to love one another. And so in this moment, we pause to recognize that you're here with us, in our hearts and minds, in our families and friendships, in our church and community and world. And now, TNC, I pray that the Lord would bless you and keep you, make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, turn his face towards you and give you peace. Amen.